Shroom 24/7. Visit shroom.com for the best in shrooms. Visit shroom.com. All right. Welcome to Shroom. We got Shane here today from Myco Love. So Shane, I met you 2 years ago. I found out about you guys from a friend over in Colorado. And he told me about this farm that he heard that popped up. He's like, oh, I think Jake Plummer's involved or something. So yeah. I was like, oh, I'm going to go check it out. So you guys welcomed me. You let me tell you my story. You guys are super welcoming. And there was one thing I told you guys. I was like, you guys can't do alcohol tinctures anymore.
Yeah.
I was like, come on, man.
Yeah.
But no, so tell me, now that, you know, it's been 2 years, I want to hear about the growth. I want to hear more about, you know, how you guys started.
Yeah, welcome, absolutely. And I'll try to keep it concise, sort of like the elevator pitch. It's not 60 seconds. It could be long. But Myco Love, I guess start with the mission. So the mission is pretty straightforward, and we don't want to be boxed in. And I can kind of unpack it as we go. And the biggest part is the mission for Myco Love is to heal through biodiversity. So there's a couple things in there. Biodiversity can be a complex term in this world of biology and science and ecosystem science. But then there's this heal aspect, and you can kind of unpack that into, we are a vertically integrated mushroom company, which is really important. It usually goes over people's heads. So this vertical integration aspect can mean all sorts of things. But for us, it means from farm to bottle, we do everything in-house. And this biodiversity angle comes in where genetics. So we literally, like Michael, who couldn't be here today, one of the other co-founders, he's a professional forager, and I love to go out myself, but I leave that into his realm. So he'll go out and he'll find genetics here in Colorado, whether it's a reishi mushroom, or he went to California and got me a lion's mane, whatever it is, turkey tail, these other mushrooms, he'll find them here on native U.S. soil. We'll bring it to the farm, we'll clone it, we'll grow it out as much as we can, and then they'll bring it over to the lab and we'll just extract it. And that part of the company is, you know, on the supplement side to heal people, not specifically people. We also create products for pets, but we also, you know, create products for anybody, really, any organism, if you will. That's a whole part of the company. And this biodiversity angle is like the genetics we acquire. And we can go into the genetic side, too. There's many kinds of mushrooms out there, many different species, a lot of which are, you know, not well understood. So there's not just the lion's mane. That would be like going into a dispensary and saying, I want the cannabis.
Right.
And they're going to be like, cool, which phenotype is the technical term, or what kind of, what version do you want? Same thing with lion's mane. There's many versions of it. We have 9 lion's mane phenotypes that all express themselves differently. So genetic diversity, this biodiversity angle, bringing that into the healing aspect, it's all going to be fractal and kind of blends into it to itself. But the other aspect of that is, you know, we want to heal the planet. So not only are we suffering, you know, we need to work on ourselves because we're, you know, creating chronic illness for ourselves. And that's pretty broad, right? So chronic illness can be mental, it can be physical, it can be we're hurting ourselves from bad diets. If you took this topic of deaths that occur over the past 2 decades and summed them up under this one topic, it'd be the 4th leading cause of death. And this topic is taking prescription medications as prescribed by your physician. So you're following the directions of who you trust, and it's killing us. We're doing that to ourselves, and we need to really better understand how to take control of our own health through more natural products, so called nutraceuticals. But basically, in a nutshell, you know, we're trying to approach the world through a sustainability lens, through a conservation lens, through a people-oriented healing themselves lens, but otherwise, we're just, floating on a space rock, really doing nothing as sentient sacks of stardust. And right. We want to put intention into what we're doing. And Myco Love tries to approach many different angles to basically spread as many spores as possible. And each spore could be a product. It could be this idea of remediating our ecosystem by collecting a genetic, from wherever you live, teaching you how to grow it out even, and then apply that back to your life, whether it's the environment or you're consuming it as food and medicine. But yeah, that's pretty straightforward. Creating high quality products that heal, healing our environment through remediative techniques, and education. I think those are the three pillars of what we stand on.
Nice. And I think I got lucky when I met you guys, because after I met you guys, I started meeting other different brands, and I started hearing, you know, I started hearing more talk about like myceliated grains. I heard started hearing more about like fruiting bodies. And I know you guys just use the fruiting bodies, but what else sets you guys apart from other extract companies?
Yeah, I mean, that was another reason why I started doing this. Was I wanted to create a superior product for myself.
Right.
'Cause you touched on a couple of really important things. And I'm really interested in this idea of biohacking myself. I love this idea of nootropics. And then through, chemistry, you can really hijack your genetic system and really induce and grow neurons. You can better learn, have better recall, better memory, all these really cool things. And I love learning. I love complex puzzles. And when you get into nootropics and you look into natural medicines, I'm really interested. I'm a conscious consumer, so I don't want to take just some reductionist compound. I want to find the most natural, potent version I can. You come across a mushroom called lion's mane, which is considered nature's most potent version of this naturally occurring product. And I was taking these capsules for months, and honestly, I couldn't really attribute this product to my mental gains, really. I was like, I don't really know. And that made me, you know, read the label and dig into it a little bit further. And you come to find out really scary statistics. I venture to say that a vast majority of the mushroom companies that are popping up that are selling products, they're not growing their own product. They're sourcing it from overseas. And then it turns out mushrooms are made of a certain material that most bodies don't know what to do with. They get stomach discomfort if you improperly prepare a mushroom, which it's because it's made of a material called chitin. So all fruiting bodies, basically, you can say are made of this material, chitin. It's what crabs are made of, crustaceans are made of, insect exoskeletons are made of this. It's a biopolymer. I like to call it nature's plastic because it's a very hardy, dense material, and your body doesn't know what to do with that. So you generally, if you're looking for a high quality therapeutic gain, you should focus on extractions. Mm-hmm. And then not only are the mushroom companies not growing their own mushrooms, not paying attention to the genetics, they're usually not even extracting it, and they're not even using the correct part of the mushroom, like you mentioned, mycelium on grain. It's not the actual fruit of the organism. And learning all of that back in 2015, 2016, I was, I like to solve complex puzzles. I was like, I'm going to give it a shot at learning to grow mushrooms, which is a whole journey in itself. Mushrooms won't, work for you. You work with them.
Right.
You work on their timeline. As if anybody's a cultivator, mushroom farming is hard.
Yeah.
No matter what the mushroom is, there's a lot of things you have to learn. It's a really niche trade that takes a long time to really dial in, and we're still dialing that in. Basically, all of these things led to me wanting to grow the mushroom, to learn about extractions, learn the chemistry behind extractions and the complexity behind that. And it even gets down to if people are, using fruit body, if they are extracting it, the question is, well, how are they extracting it? So there's a lot of complexities built into this, and a lot of companies aren't really transparent on any of this. And then it results in most people saying, oh, I tried that mushroom. It's snake oil.
Yeah.
And it's really like, let me see the product.
Yeah. And there's more and more popping up on Amazon every day. I'm like, oh my gosh, man. It's like, it's horrible.
Yeah. Scrolling through your feed, it's like mushroom company, mushroom company, mushroom company.
Yeah.
And which is great. Mushrooms are, like, since I started digging into this, they're blowing up, like, getting really popular. And really, they're really transformative. They are entities. They are allies that can really help our evolution on this planet. And I want the justice that's required, the due diligence required to offer these things as a ally is really important. All of these things that we're talking about are all the things that we focus on here at MycoLove. And we're not dogmatic. There's not one way to extract mushrooms.
Right.
Each mushroom, you can look at the research on extractions and publications, and you understand A lot of the research is based on individual compounds like cordyceps. They're like, well, these are the best parameters to extract corticepin, but each mushroom could have hundreds of compounds with different chemistry. So what we are angled at doing for the past 2 years is every week we're doing R&D on how do we get a better and better product for the consumer market. But I think, again, all of these things that we're talking about are all things that are in our wheelhouse of trying to figure out to create a better product for people so that they don't have a bad experience or that they don't feel like they're wasting their money. They're getting the most therapeutic bang for their buck, if you will.
Right.
And keep going. I'm just going to close this door so it's not so loud.
And that's why, now that I love the glycerin ones that you guys have, and I feel like just because you could put them in your coffee, you could put them in cereal, you could put them in anything. Really.
Yeah.
So that's the why I like those the most. And I and honestly, like, you don't need gummies, you don't need any, all these other like extra edibles, because if you just have straight concentrate, you can really do whatever you want.
You can make your own gummies, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You know, not only do we have a whole retail side, the Michael of products, mm-hmm. if you will, you know, shameless plug here, here's the line,
yeah.
right? But we also, like, early on it was about the intention was to create, you know, to one aspect of our mission in the world of supplements is to create high quality therapeutic products that heal. We don't care if it has our name on it or not. So we also private label, we also custom formulate, we custom extract. And then the nice thing about being vertically integrated, we can really control not only the growing aspect, which has its whole world of R&D to grow the mushroom the best that you can, but the extraction side, since we do all the extractions, we can customize as much as we want. So we want more products in more hands, regardless of what it is or if it has our name on it.
Right.
So we do supply bulk extracts to people who do make gummies or make bars or make these, they're called value-added products, right?
Right.
And we were at Expo West this year, which almost was last year, 2023. We were a little early to the game, unfortunately, which is fine. We're just ahead of our time. But what I saw, what you can see at these expos is like what the next few years is going to entail.
Right.
And these new product launches were basically taking an everyday product and then functionalizing it.
Right.
It doesn't matter what it is,
yeah.
whether it's a carbonated water, it's a bar, it's a burger, it's a gummy, it's whatever. And what I realized is like, oh, there's going to be an explosion of these health products, which are great, but they're going
to
be sourcing from...
You need to get it sucked. Yeah, they're going to be sourcing these crap products.
Exactly. So we made a decision early on to be able to supply these other companies that are, you know, getting off the ground. And because the idea is like, it would suck to come out with a really awesome concept and then have a bunk product because
right.
people aren't going to come back to you.
Yeah.
So we want to change the narrative around mushrooms and supplying U.S. companies as well as international companies. We're not just stuck here in the U.S.
Right.
We want to supply everyone.
And it cuts down on you losing a lot of product. Like, you know how much research and development you'll have to go through just to find after, you know, cooking it, it's going to obviously degrade a lot of the product. So
yeah, and again, improperly prepared mushrooms, it can be really damaging. Yeah,
right.
For sure. Just not having a therapeutic product. And you're spending a lot of money on these things.
Exactly.
Right? You're buying, a lot of people are spending like $1 a gram for, you know, a grain. Which is like, okay, well, why don't you take one of our workshops? We'll show you how to grow a pound of it for 50 cents. You know, if you want mycelium on grain, do it yourself. I mean, come on.
Speaking of, like, you guys are using other products, tell me about this collab you have going on with, is it a beverage company?
Yeah, we've done a couple different collaborations, locally specifically. The one that I was mentioning to you, we have another one, though, which is really cool, but this one was a local cidery called Stem Ciders. They're just down the road here. They have very similar ethos. Most cider companies will source cider concentrate, and then they'll make their cider out of that. They have a full-time truck driver that drives to the Pacific Northwest, gets their apples, and they bring it back, and they do everything in-house, and they want quality over quantity at the end of the day. And that's where we're like, yeah, thank you. Welcome to the table. And they wanted to, you know, they thought it would be really cool to try to create a functional cider. So they're releasing a canned neural nectar, which is our lion's mane extract in a cider. I think it's a cherry limeade. It is awesome.
Nice.
They're really awesome formulators. And then the other one we just had is a turkey tail beer.
Okay.
Haven't tried it yet, but super stoked. It's a brewery here in Boulder called Wild Provisions. And these guys are on the same ethos. They will go out and collect yeast from the wild locally.
Oh, nice.
And they're like, we want to use local products to create our beverages. And they're like, well, let's try a mushroom version. We're like, hell yeah. So we get hooked them up with some turkeytail extract. So hopefully we'll be able to try that soon. That'd be
awesome.
Really cool. Yeah.
And so tell me more. We kind of went a little bit backwards, but you weren't just some, you know, guy who started like getting into mushrooms. Tell us a little bit about your background and your education, because I think that will help kind of tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. My undergrad was in ecology and evolutionary biology. So really heavy on the ecology of the ecosystem. I was really fascinated by this world of conservation biology, which is where this word biodiversity really comes in. And I should define that a little bit. So this word biodiversity, you understand Latin at all, it's just the diversity of biology in an ecosystem. And it literally kind of boils down to the amount of different genetics in an ecosystem. So a good example would be if you had a cornfield, a monoculture, just straight corn, those are all genetically identical. There's no biodiversity. It's zero, basically, or it's one, right? Or technically it's a fraction. So it's a very small number. It's just one genetic, which is really difficult because this comes into a bigger play where you have to use pesticides, herbicides, and you have to use synthetic inputs, all that stuff, because there's no diversity in there, so it's really susceptible to these things, and it can be really damaging to an ecosystem. It turns out the more diversity you have in an ecosystem, it can be boiled down to the healthier it is, whether that's withstanding forest fire, whether that's rebounding from earthquake or floods, whether that's soil building or retention or nutrient retention and diversification. And all of these things literally equate to a healthier ecosystem. So biodiversity is where I really learned to dug into that. And then evolution is a whole other aspect I bring to the table, and it's mostly in the genetic world. And we can dig into what that means in the mushroom side. It can be really complex. And, you know, during my undergrad, if you're in any sort of ecosystem science or environmental science, you're bombarded with a deluge of negativity of what we are doing to our ecosystem as humans. And you can be really jaded from a four-year endeavor digging into this stuff. And learning about it isn't the bad thing. I think what bothered me the most is that there wasn't a whole lot of what can we do about it.
Right.
And that really gave me this existential dread or this existential crisis. And I really went through a period of time where I was lost. And I was like, at the end of finals, I'm like, it doesn't matter. There's no hope. Like, we're just going to drive this ship into the ground. But then I came back and realized, like, hey, how can I make the biggest, as a singular person, make the biggest impact that I can for helping?
Right.
You know, healing, if you will. And I didn't learn a thing about mycology as an undergrad, but luckily I was able to learn a lot, you know, laboratory techniques. And because of my undergrad, I had a lot of opportunity in working for ecosystem science in those realms. I worked for a lab that was mainly focused on, so labs are really determined on the equipment they have. They can do all sorts of things. So this lab was not only did they do like potency testing for cannabis or heavy metals, but also for agriculture, for food labels, food science, but also the chemistry and microbiology behind water sampling. And they had a microbiology lab, all that kind of stuff. And I was able to kind of jump from section to section. And then as an undergrad working in genetics, looking at antibiotic resistant bacteria in watersheds, you know, learning about agar and all this stuff, gave me the tools, it turns out, necessary to really look at mushrooms and grow mushrooms. But all of these things really led to this concept of circular economy. I don't know if you've heard of this term, circular economy.
Oh, I haven't, no.
Great. I think it's more, it's not new necessarily, but the term is pretty new. And all these things that I was really focused on was how to be more sustainable in an ecosystem. If you take this idea of circular economy and you apply fungi to it, it's this idea where there's closed loops. So maybe whatever you produce is used again, right? There's no waste necessarily. It's a closed off system. And it turns out fungi are great candidates for a really closed loop system, whether that's food, medicine, technology, whatever.
Yeah.
Like you can do mycomaterials that are fully biodegradable.
Yeah.
They have really good R value, which means really good insulators. They're fire resistant, you know. Then you can do food, right? So you can take an agricultural waste and you can grow mushrooms on it.
What was your mind going when you figured this out? Or like, how long did it take you to really like realize this?
I think really what hammered, I think all of these things were kind of floating in the ether for me.
Yeah.
And what really propelled me and really kind of organized it in a very clear circular mandalic effect, if you will, was psychedelics.
Yeah.
Right? So I had this subconscious understanding of all these things I learned. And I was like, how do I apply them to my ecosystem or to the planet, if you will? And then through, therapeutic doses of psychedelics, whether that's psilocybin, ayahuasca, or LSD, it really organized it in a way that says, I think this is your calling.
Yeah.
All these things are in your head. Let me help you see it.
Right.
And that's what's really cool about this idea of the unconscious, the subconscious, and humanity, is we have this ability for alchemy, the philosopher's stone, to transmutate these creative things that are in your mind and manifest them into physical reality.
Right.
Like, we're magicians.
Yeah.
We're fucking wizards.
Yeah.
And that's powerful.
Very powerful.
And then without intention behind that is where we get into trouble, right? If your intention is to grow and just produce and pull in money,
right?
The growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of a cancer cell.
Yeah.
Edward Abbey. Like that resonated heavy with me. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, even in the 60s, this dude, like, he knew what was up.
Yeah. I just heard that just like a couple days ago. So it was weird that you said that again.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And that is a big aspect in, yes. The other thing too is we do, and we've talked about this in the beginning, we live in a capitalistic environment. Sure, you can have this anarchist approach, but we live in this system, and I realize that you can work outside of the system. All, you know, best of luck to you, for sure, whoever you are. There's a way of doing that. But the angle of which I saw that made sense for me is like, how do I change the system from within? And really try to be the change I want to see in the world, as overused as that term is. It's a Gandhi term there.
I think it shows a lot of dedication on your side too. And I see it from the outside because I talk to you about, like, I check in with you here and there, and you tell me about like these plans that you have, and it's like plans are so far in the future for you. Like, you have plans for Michael Love like years and years, and I'm like, oh, what about this? What about this? Like, no. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you tell me a little bit about how you have your outlook for Michael Love.
Yeah. So, and this has really been core values have been really important to me, and how I really tried to build the company and the mental model of which I used to kind of put these sunglass lens on was network theory and mycelial networks. And I really tried to use that as a tool and biomimicry to develop the business structure, and the core values. And one thing that I tried to do is sort of look ahead as well. And yeah, Michael Love for sure is looking 5 years out, and we have products that we don't have commercially because people are going to be like, what do we do with this? We're kind of aiming for the future because I think that's where the importance comes in. And product quality is a good aspect of that. And what really is a challenge is that whether it's a private label, a wholesale client, or whoever wants to come to the market and they want to create a product, they want quality, but they don't want to pay for it.
Right.
And then you have to balance, well, the capitalistic market, why there's bunk products on the market is because capitalism breeds an environment of which you capitalize on the ignorance of your consumer base. And that is disgusting.
So you're letting this play out, letting people get all these crap products, and then you're still going to be out here, you know?
Well, and this is a good example of going too much in the weeds, but when you are making, in the extraction side at least, when you're making an extract, again, not even paying attention to genetics.
Right.
Like, that's a whole nother world.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And there are going to be better genetics for certain products, and nobody's looking at that. So that's something we're already looking at and researching, like, what's the difference between the genetic diversity of sister species? So, and not to go too off on the weeds here about thinking ahead, But on the genetic side, I guess this is a little rant I'd like to go into. This is how far we're digging into it. Like I said, there's not just the lion's mane. And it turns out there's different phenotypes of that species. But if you look at fungal genetics, there's not a clear-cut line between different close related species. And a good example, oysters are a good example. There's oysters of every color.
Yeah.
They can't crossbreed necessarily. They're sort of different species, but they have very similar overlap of compounds availability.
Yeah.
So lion's mane has sister species. So we have lion's mane that grow here in North America. We had a clone, Aracium arenaceus is the Latin binomial, but the Aracium section has different species that are closely related. So ones found here in the U.S. that are very promising is we have a clone from Iowa called Coralloides. It's a bear's head tooth, I think it's a common name. And then Americanum, which is from Pennsylvania. They are both Aracium species, but they're not the lion's mane specific.
Yeah.
And so my hypothesis kind of going into this on the genetic side is that the gene clusters that evolved to produce these awesome compounds arguably probably came from a common ancestor. So psilocybin is a good example of this. Psilocybin, it comes from a gene cluster, and it evolved based on the current publications. This is, again, theoretical.
Yeah.
Like, there's not, like, how do we know? It's like, well, based on genetic dating for these molecular clocks you can make 20 million years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, so the question is, like, what was going on planet Earth 20 million years ago that this thing evolved? And then it spread like wildfire through a vertical gene transfer, so lateral transfer to different genetics, and it just spread like wildfire to psilocybe, to inosybe, to genopolis.
Where's that original at?
Yeah, and it's like, why? The question is why?
Yeah.
But anyway, psilocybin evolved a long time ago, and when you have a really awesome trait, you'll pass that on to the future. And then those will evolve to different species, but they gained that product production gene in earlier species. I held that hypothesis before those papers were published, and I held it with like lion's mane, and reishi is a good example. And what was awesome is a recent publication on Coralloides came out to show that the fruiting body has these potent they upregulate the gene expression for neurite outgrowth, NGF, which is nerve growth factor, or BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic. Anyway, these things will help with neuron growth, which can be for the brain, the body, doesn't matter. But the big argument really has been in the lion's mane realm that you want to use the mycelium because it has these select tiny amount of diverse compounds called aranacines that have been identified in the mycelium. But the question is, what phenotype were they looking at, right?
So they're just guessing.
Yeah, they're like saying the lion's mane in the mycelium has this, but it's like that's too broad.
Yeah.
And my question was, well, is it possible that these potent nootropics are found in the fruit body of a sister species instead of the mycelium? Because the mycelium is not, it's just on grain, everybody can agree on this, is not as potent as the hyper-condensed fruiting body.
Right.
And it turns out, you know, we know what we know, we know what we don't know, but we don't know what we don't know, which is infinite.
So you got to keep looking.
You got to keep looking. And then as I've been digging into this for lion's mane specifically, they've been able to identify, originally it was 50 compounds. And then a couple of years later, we're at 70. And then most recently, it's 102 compounds found in the complex of lion's mane between the fruiting body and mycelium, majority of these being in the fruit body. The fruit body has, like, I think 12 different versions of nootropics versus the one found in the mycelium. So that already puts that to bed.
Yeah.
But then the Coralloides mushroom, these aranacine-type compounds, they called coralloisins, are found in the fruiting body. So I was, like, really early on, it's like, I guarantee we can find a more potent version of these neurostimulators or neurite outgrowth promoters in a fruiting body, because when you do a fruiting body extraction, you're just getting a far more potent, diverse amount of compounds weight-wise than you would ever get out of mycelium. To reach the equivalence, you'd have to use an insane amount of mycelium to get even just a fraction of what you can out of a small amount of fruit.
Right.
So anyway, that's gone really far original question.
You helped explain a lot, though.
Yeah, and you know, going far out there and kind of what we're digging into, but I don't know any other companies that are doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
That really take an angle of science. And again, I want to be careful. We're not 2 feet in science. We're 1 foot in science, 1 foot in mysticism. because there was a lot to learn from Hermeticism, from the original alchemists that kind of went out there. They had a lot of intuition and plant ally knowledge, and we have that today, where science could never make ayahuasca.
Right.
Like, there's millions of diverse plants in the Amazon, and that these tribal communities, these natives, have really dialed in to attune with their environment and really listen to their environment. I think that's really important, because if you're 2 feet in science, your entire basis is in reduction into a singular compound. That's another thing too, is it gets really complex, because even in the product world, how do you identify a quality product? Like, that's a huge...
You trust what the label says.
Yeah, and then what is not on the label? Anything, really.
Right.
And
unless you're going to do, like, a smart consumer would, go do the research on the company, maybe go to their website. Hopefully that, shows a little bit about them. But that's why we just got to be smarter as people, too.
Yeah, and those people will find the right companies. But vast majority of people don't want to do that, right? What happens is they check their trust at the door of the store they go into.
Yeah.
Because if you're going into name brand health food store, we all know what you're thinking of.
Yeah.
You leave your trust at the door and you assume that the product on the shelf is quality because it's in that store.
Yeah.
That is not the case.
Not at all.
No. So what we're just trying to do is just change the narrative. Because when we're talking about product quality, when I walked into the room, I tripped over the bar because it was so low.
Right.
And what we're trying to do is reestablish the bar to say, no. This is like a baseline quality product that should be out there. And the question is, like, how do you measure that? It's really complicated too. And that's what we're really trying to figure out. It's like, we're trying to cast the widest net possible when it comes to mushrooms, because it's about this word called Gestalt. I don't know if you've heard that word. It's a German word. But it's the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, right? So if you were to take any individual compound found in a mushroom, so we can break down mushrooms into many classes of chemistry,
right.
But generally speaking, blanket statement 101 here, you can have these polysaccharides, mm-hmm. which are these water solubles, like beta-glucan,
right.
It's an immunomodulator, and then you can have this other class called triterpenoids, which many people have heard of terpenes and terpenoids,
right.
these volatile aromatic compounds found in cannabis. It's a great example. They're also in mushrooms, but in different versions. They have terpenes, they have diterpenes, they have triterpenes,
wow.
and they have sesquiterpenes. Very complex chemistry. They're the grand
chemists.
So
what year is that going to be the buzzword?
Hopefully soon.
So right now it's like beta-glucan.
Beta-glucan. Yeah. And if you're focused on beta-glucans, great. Eat an oyster or do an oyster extraction. Don't, when you look for a lion's mane and you're looking for beta-glucan as your potency marker, doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and that's something that I read before coming here. I was doing just picking up on my research and stuff, and I read oysters, like the golden oysters, they have a lot of these beneficial, like, beta-glucans in them, where I'm like, wow, they should be doing oysters next.
Yeah, no, exactly, and that's where we're really battling with people, too, and when they are, we're going in the right direction.
Yeah.
It's a ladder, it's a escalator marathon to the top, and we're on our way, so people are asking, well, before it was, like, lion's mane, and you're, like, didn't ask any questions, well, what's the potency? Like, that's a very simple question, right? So that's being asked now, which is really good. And then if you get a little further, it's like, well, how do you measure potency? And people are saying, well, you measure beta-glucans. Well, that's a far cry from the truth, because when we're talking about lion's mane or anything, yeah, you're looking at, well, for lion's mane, right, we're interested in these nootropic compounds. These beta-glucans are not those. They are beneficial, don't get me wrong, but that's not what we're looking for. And what sucks is that some of these nootropic compounds, they're diterpenoids, which if you do a quality extraction are found in sort of the alcohol side.
Mm-hmm.
These beta-glucans are water. So you can do we can get really high beta-glucan numbers by removing the diverse other compounds in there,
right.
by isolation. And that's where the mushroom companies are moving towards. They're looking for higher and higher beta-glucan numbers by isolating it out. But by isolating, you're removing all of the nootropics. Yeah, and if you're looking at cordyceps and beta-glucan, well, cordycepin is not a beta-glucan. You're removing it from the equation. And then talking about reishi, can have 400 or 500 compounds in it, and if you have a really high beta-glucan, you're not getting anything else. So that's where we're trying to really figure out how to communicate a high diverse product being quality to the consumer base, but there's no way to do like a shotgun compound analysis, because even labs are really far away from measuring the nootropics in lion's mane. Or
it costs a lot of money, and I don't think a lot of these mushroom companies have that kind of money to be doing this.
I worked with many different labs trying to figure this out. We're making movement, but one standard, like the standard that's used to a reference material to test potency if we're looking at the nootropics in lion's mane, which there are many.
Yeah.
If you just got one of these, it's like $20,000-$25,000. Wow. So there's just not enough interest in the consumer model right now to fork out the cash for a lab to do that test. Sure, they can recoup their costs, but it's like how many tests do they have to run to recoup it? And we're not there yet. Yeah.
So one question that I wanted to ask you, just as far as cordyceps, because I'm fascinated with cordyceps, just the energy I get from them in the morning is like, I don't even need coffee. I just take it, and I can feel it. Like, I'll take an energy drink in the past, and I'm like, I wonder if it's going to work. Like, no, cordyceps, I feel good. But then I started reading about, like, the Nepal cordyceps with the S.
Sinus. Yeah.
So how far are we from a strain like that, and what do we get from the Militaris that we don't get from that?
Great question. And I'll go a little bit into sort of the folklore and the history of this mushroom, right? So cordyceps, as a species complex, there's many species of cordyceps on the planet, it turns out. And they're entomopathogenic fungi, which means I hate this word pathogen or parasitic, because in the general population, just every day, parasites are bad. Parasites equal bad. But in the world of ecology, swing this term back, biodiversity, right? So if you're in a complex ecosystem and an insect specifically starts overpowering and driving out other species, whether they're over-consuming their food, whether they're attacking other insects, whatever they're doing, they're removing biodiversity. So mushrooms like cordyceps evolved to come in from a top-down approach to drop that species down again. And when they come in and they lower that dominator, the other diversity come back in. So they're really beneficial to our ecosystems, right? But there's many species, I think to date, again, we don't know what we don't know,
right.
But what we have figured out is there's over 720, I think, species of cordyceps that each attack different insects.
Okay.
Species of cordyceps that are entomopathogenic, and they're all over the world, it turns out, except for this one, Cordyceps sinensis, which has been reclassified, and I'll go into that. So Cordyceps sinensis is really where cordyceps became aware to the consumer world, and I think I don't even know how far back it goes, but these nomadic cattle herders would herd their... This is... Legend has it, right? I don't actually know. I don't think anybody actually knows, but the story goes that these cattle herders were herding their cattle, and they're all ages, these cattle, young and older, and they would notice the older cattle, when they would eat these orange mushrooms popping out of the ground, they would have more vitality, and it would be like they're young again. And they're like, oh, obviously, I'm going to try this myself. And they saw tremendous benefits. And what you see are all sorts of endurance-type benefits. I guess we'll go into the chemistry of that a little bit. So cordyceps sinensis, as well as cordyceps militaris, the chemistry is really interesting, which put a pin in the chemistry. I want to finish the story first. The cordyceps sinensis can be problematic. Because it is you can only wild harvest this mushroom.
Right.
And it turns out this isn't a singular species. It's a mushroom complex. It's a compound species, sort of like a lichen.
Okay.
So lichen is not just, it's made up of three different things, right? It's made up of an algal cell, a fungal cell, and a yeast cell. And you can't take these individual ones, if you rip them apart, they're not a lichen anymore.
Right.
And if you take all three of them and put them together, they don't form a lichen, it turns out. Like it just is that. And Cordyceps sinensis is a compound species like that. It's made up of two other species. And these infect the insect, and then they grow through it, and it's sort of like an arms race.
Okay.
And it's this interwoven interaction that occurs as it's growing through the insect that produces the compound load.
Got it.
So when people... You can't grow it turns out.
Yeah.
People have isolated one of the three, and they'll grow it out on mycelium, and it doesn't have any of the properties because it's not the complex or the compound species. But either way, even if you got the compound species, no one has cracked the code on how to fruit it in an artificial condition.
I've heard people try to do it in like hyperbaric chambers.
All sorts of stuff. I mean, someone's going to crack the code for sure. But the problem is it's wild harvested only. And it only occurs in a certain part of the world at a certain elevation at a certain time of the year. And when you put humans in the same sentence as wild harvesting, it always equals unsustainability. And we're over-harvesting it because it's at one point in time, Cordyceps senescens that's been reclassified as Cordyceps Ophiocordyceps senescens because it's a compound species. And you can only wild harvest it. And at one point in time, dry, it was worth more than than the weight of gold per kilo because it was that sought after. What's amazing, here comes, you know, there's other Cordyceps species. And it turns out one that we know of, there's many that we need to look into. But the one that we have really dove into in the U.S. as soon as 2016-ish was Cordyceps militaris. And why this mushroom is interesting is it has basically the same compounds as a Ophiocordyceps senescens, but you can fruit it without insects, and you can fruit it in a mushroom farm, basically. And because of breeding, and you know how we are with genetics, you look at cannabis, like there's underground breeders, they do really good work. They have been able to breed this thing to have higher amounts and higher concentrations of cordycepin, of these other beneficial compounds than the wild harvested version. So it's actually better to get to Cordyceps militaris, one, because it's more sustainable, two, you know how it's grown, arguably, and it's just way more sustainable at the end of the day. But the compounds that we're interested in, these endurance-type compounds are, you know, we said it a couple times, cordycepin, but it's got cordymin, cordyxanthins, cordycepines, which are like these terpenes. It's got a whole class of compounds, but what we're interested in is cordycepin. Now, if you were to pause this and you were to Google the molecular structure of cordycepin, and then you Googled the molecular structure of adenosine, you would see that they're basically virtually indistinguishable. And they're indistinguishable by the body. And why that's important is because every cell in your body has a mitochondria. Thank your mother and their mother, because that's where you get your mitochondria evolutionarily. They gave it to you, but you would not survive without a mitochondria. It is crucial for the survival of us in general. And what it does, many different things. One of the aspects is we all memorize this in science class, that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. Someone out there finished that. You're in there. Thank you. But the powerhouse of the cell. So in, what does that mean? So it uses something called, ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate. And that is consumed in a process using ATP synthase. All that doesn't matter, but it equals energy. So when you have this adenosine in your system, it equals energy, which is higher metabolic function, which can be better oxygen intake. It can be more output. It can lower your metabolic age. It can do all of these awesome things. And the way I think about it is, you know, I'm a runner. I'm a climber, but running is a good example, or if you're a cyclist or whatever.
It helps your lung capacity is what I read.
Totally. It's a VO2 max. Yeah, so it's this idea of you get more oxygen intake.
So this is not like it's a guess. Like, it's science.
Science, yeah. And the best way I think about it is, like, if you're a runner or hiker or just, you don't have to be this endurance athlete. You can just be a normal-ass person that works. And if you want more, if you get winded on a daily basis or during your hike or bike session or running, whatever, you hit a wind wall.
Yeah.
And it moves the wind wall for you. This will kind of sum up with all functional mushrooms. We can go into each of the mushrooms too. But what we do know from clinical research is that to get the maximum benefit out of any of these mushrooms, it needs to be consumed at a therapeutic level. And that's pretty vague because it depends on product quality, it depends on genetics, all that kind of stuff. It needs to be consumed at a therapeutic level on a daily basis for a prolonged amount of time. Like, that's pretty straightforward for all functional mushrooms to get the maximum benefit. And what does that mean is daily.
Right.
So we're here in Colorado. Do you climb?
I don't climb, but I try to do some endurance. You run and stuff like that.
Perfect. But point being, would you call yourself a climber if you climbed once in your lifetime?
Oh, no way.
Right. Yeah. It would be kind of, it doesn't make sense. Like, if I climbed once 10 years ago, I don't walk around and say I'm a climber, right? It's something I'm actively working on.
So you're not a shroomer unless you shroom every day.
Totally. Exactly. And it's a lifestyle. Sort of, yeah. Right? It's a habit. It's a ritual that you kind of build.
But people drink an energy drink every day of their life.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's killing you. Why not take something naturally?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
You get more from the nootropics.
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing with functional mushrooms. Like, you need to take them on a daily basis. Like if you want to get healthy, you can't eat broccoli once and say you're healthy, right? So when you do when you take mushrooms, you should take them on a daily basis for a prolonged amount of time. You should also be like working on yourself too, right? Yeah. You can't get smarter from eating or consuming lion's mane extract. You actually have to like be reading. You have to be working that muscle.
It's like exercising those parts, those nerves, those muscles.
Exactly.
Everything.
Exactly. Same thing with functional mushrooms.
Nice. I know. I gave my mom some. She loves the lion's mane. She's in her 70s, so she feels like she's getting more functionality in her daily life. So one thing she asked me, though, is when should I take them? Like, so is there a certain time you should take the turkey tail, a certain time you should take the lion's mane? Maybe does it cause drowsiness at all?
Well, yeah, so that's a complex question, and I don't think that any clinical research has been done on the time frame. The best way I recommend it, as long as it gets in your system daily. Because it depends on the mushroom too, right? So some people are super sensitive. So there might be a reason why you would take some in the morning or some in the afternoon or kind of whatever. But yeah, so like cordyceps, I would recommend taking in the morning, just in case, or like halfway through the day or as needed kind of throughout the day. Lion's mane, again, you can take it whenever. Yeah. If you really want to have crazy dreams, take it before you go to bed. Reishi, again, so most of these effects we're talking about, whether it's this cognitive performance, whether this energy, and then reishi, which we haven't gotten into, is considered a superior adaptogen.
Yep.
And then turkey tail is like this immune kind of complex and gut health. These effects are accumulative. So that's why this word therapeutic dose can be sort of vague, because as long as you're getting it in your system, it's going to compile over a matter of time until you've accumulated it.
Right.
And then the goal after accumulation is to maintain that effect. So we see this with clinical research in lion's mane. It could take some people, you know, say they notice it in a week or two. But, you know, clinically, they measure people usually after 4 weeks, 6 months, a year. Like,
yeah.
There's a long amount of usage here. And they see the biggest gains out of long duration of use. But, and again, it's this idea of accumulation over time. So once you maintain that, and you stop taking the mushroom, it turns out, it fades after about 2 to 3 weeks, too.
Oh, wow.
So it's okay if you miss a dose here or there, for sure. And these gains that you get are, you know, there, but then you won't gain any more if you stop your consumption of these mushrooms.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know. So how important would you say, and you can answer this, you don't have to answer this, but would you say, like, psilocybin is, like, could that be considered a functional mushroom for some? Or are we not getting enough from that?
So, I mean, I can think about it in two different ways. And part of my analytical brain is thinking about clinical research.
Right.
And clinically, without psilocybin in the mix, they've measured 130 some odd amount of functions that occur from taking mushrooms. That's what this idea of functional, why do we use the word functional, right? That's important to define here. So we started talking more about functional mushrooms and being very clear instead of saying medicinal mushrooms.
Right.
Because there's nothing wrong with this, but when we meet people and say, oh, we're a medicinal mushroom company, they're like, oh, where do I get psilocybin?
Right.
Sign me up. And it's like, that's cool, but as a commercial operation in Colorado, there's no legal pathway for commercial psilocybin production at this point.
Right.
So we do not produce psilocybin. We do produce other magic mushrooms, because all mushrooms are magic,
right?
Exactly. And we differentiate that by saying functional mushrooms. So these functions, there's many different functions that we just kind of covered here in this conversation. And I think over 630 different species have been measured at this point for some functionality for the human body. Psilocybin is its own realm, right? So what is the functional aspect of psilocybin? We all know, right? Mental health is a big aspect. Nootropic, it turns out.
Right.
There might be immunomodulation going on. There's no measurement of that yet,
right,
though. So the functional aspect of psilocybin, I guess we could, I would say the way I think about functional mushrooms is they help you function at a higher level.
Got it.
And I would say psilocybin helps individuals, but, you know, the right dosage,
right, obviously,
you know, the right person, the right, you know, there's a lot of complexity that goes into it. Because cordyceps is another example that might not be the best for some people. Some people I've noticed personally, anecdotally, they don't need that endurance. They
right.
don't need that energy. They get really aggro.
Got
they
it.
Get angry. And it's like, I have this low level of like anger. And I think it's just pent up energy and they just need to go on a run or something. I don't know. But all mushrooms aren't for everybody. There's a different combination of mushrooms, different species that are really good for certain individuals.
Right.
Psilocybin is the same way. But I do think that, you know, it will come out that there are other functional aspects of psilocybin-containing mushrooms. And then to get into the complexity of it, you know, the compounds that are in the psilocybe, right, is it just psilocybin, right?
Exactly.
You know, psilocin and psilocybin are synonymous because psilocybin converts to psilocin to cross the blood-brain barrier. But when we talk about psilocybe cubensis specifically, there's all these different phenotypes in that realm, right? And the one thing that bothers me, and it's a complex conversation, I see, you see it in the forums all the time, that a cube is a cube is a cube.
Oh, yeah.
And the question is like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like saying, well, a cannabis is a cannabis is a cannabis. And it's like, no, you know, there's a complex sommelier wheel of effect that occurs with cannabis because of the complex amount of compound diversity. It's not just about THC,
right?
They tried that. They made synthetic, I forgot the name of the synthetic THC product they made for cancer patients.
Marinol.
Yeah. And people were like, nah, not for me.
Yeah.
What it was is this entourage effect, which should be reclassified as ensemble effect. And I can't claim that that's from those guys at Oakland Hi-Fi.
Okay.
I heard them talking about it, and it made a lot of sense to me that entourage kind of says there's one major player and these sidekicks. Nah, it's more like you go to an orchestra and it's about the ensemble experience.
Right.
It's not about just the cello player. It's not just about the piano. It's about everything working in consortium together.
Right.
And that's what it turns out for psilocybin as well. We've been able to identify, the mushroom complex, the industry in laboratories and research publications have been able to identify many other psychedelic compounds. Norbaycistin, baycistin, psilodelta-10, you know, there's these. And it's really complex.
Yeah.
And it turns out there could be hundreds of these compounds found in these mushrooms in different ratios, in different forms. And it turns out how the entourage effect occurs chemically in your body at the receptor site for cannabis is that THC will adhere, or these cannabinoid will adhere to the receptor site, and then the terpene will also fit in it. And it modulates the experience based on the shape that it creates for that receptor site. Psilocybin, psilocybe cubensis specifically, not only does it have these array of tryptamines, but it also has terpenes in them. And these terpenes could be the reason you have these different phenotypical, or these different strains that have different effects on people. Because, an ape is not a B+.
Right?
Exactly. Obviously, they look different potencies altogether, but it's really interesting. I'd love to see sort of like a sommelier palate wheel or effect wheel for these psilocybin strains, because I try to think about it. You have like more mental, more vision, heightened smell, more body load, if you will. You know, and I think those could be, and I say they
once
are.
You isolate that stuff.
Yeah, it could be attributed to these different complex tryptamines or these terpenes found also in these mushrooms. It's about this ensemble effect. So that's where, you know, if we were to get into the space, once that pathway is there, our interest is, you know, there's going to be a big debate on should it be extracted or not, right? That's always a debate. So, you know, people do say that it removes it from the natural state.
Yeah.
Well, what is ayahuasca,
right?
And I hear this argument with LSD all the time. Well, it came from a fungus, right? It's all, at the end of the day, it's all chemistry.
Right.
But there is complexity, though. I don't want to lessen that as long as you aren't isolating, that's a little different. And that's why we want to come to the space. Because I think there's going to be a lot of psilocybin labs that extract psilocybin specifically to isolate psilocybin. Well, what about the ensemble effect?
Right.
So what we want to bring to the table is we want to do extractions of a wide net to get all of these synergistic partners out so that you have a well-rounded, balanced product for a well-rounded, balanced therapeutic session rather than just a isolated psilocybin pill, right? Yeah.
Well, I'm excited. I mean, we know we're probably years and years from that, but it's exciting to know that we're going to get there one day.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, there's a lot of different testing companies coming out with different tests. You see different tryptamines in them. I've seen a lot of different stuff that I need to. I wouldn't be able to read it, but I'd show you, and you'd probably know right away.
Yeah. It's cool that the advances for the home, like, and we have to attribute like all of this. Like, I got into this as an avid hobbyist. Like, I was just like, I want to grow mushrooms for myself. And it's because of people like you or anybody in the space that pioneers these things. And I remember like the take home kits that would test psilocybin, Miralax, I can't remember what it's called. Mm-hmm. It used to be like $200 a pop. And someone told me it's like $25.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa. Like, yeah, give me 10.
Or you used to just have the pinches, see how blue it got.
Exactly. That's how the original penis movie was. Yeah.
I was listening to that with Hamilton.
It's Hamilton's Morris, yeah. I forgot the guy who bred it, but it was like, I was like, oh, is that simple?
Gutierrez,
yeah. Super interesting story.
Yeah, and that's what I took away from that, too. It's like, I see people all day, like, throwing away all these abortions. I'm like, well, why don't we just try to isolate that and keep growing
and then,
it?
Exactly. Like, find the weirdest looking thing. And that's how a lot of genetics, like, you look what's different. And it's what's interesting is a lot of the genetic work that's done is by home cultivators, underground, you know, breeders and stuff like that. And they're using aesthetic qualities.
Yeah, they don't even know what they have inside.
No, it's just like, yeah, that one blued a little bit darker, or a little bit faster.
Yeah.
This one looks more like a penis. This one looks like a blob, you know,
yeah.
Which is cool. I mean, nothing wrong with that, but I think there's going to be an advancement where you might be able to do a quick analysis of what's inside of it to help.
We could be losing something else. That's very important for what we need.
Exactly. Who knows what has been lost so far?